Very good. Good morning. Today I have the general heading for this talk, Ethics for One World, which refers to the topic of a recent book of mine called One World, which was published by Yale University Press last year, and of which a Spanish translation is forthcoming, although it has not yet appeared. And I suppose this book and this development of my philosophical interests has been stimulated largely by living in the United States and being involved in discussions particularly focused on American policy, US policy, on a range of issues, but leading me to look at some of the questions about globalization and the development of the world community into a more of a single community. So, stimulated partly, of course, by the demonstrations in Seattle in December 1999, which was the first major awakening, I guess, in public consciousness of the idea of the World Trade Organization as being a highly controversial and contested idea as to how the world should become more one global community. So, what I do in the book One World is to look at a range of different areas in which there are issues about the way in which we are becoming more of a global community and the way in which we face problems that need to be addressed on a global level. And while some of these questions are factual questions and perhaps questions of politics, there was some discussion yesterday, of course, about to what extent the issues that I talked about then, about the obligations to assist should be seen as political and to what extent as ethical questions. These too can be seen from a different perspective, ethical, political, and so on. But one of the reasons why I thought it was important to write this book was precisely to show that there is an ethical dimension to these problems. Because I felt in listening to the discussion in the United States that this ethical dimension was very often left out. That is that, take for example the first of the topics, which is which I will talk about, the question of global warming or climate change and the contribution of human activities towards that development, and the questions of what each nation ought to do about it, and particularly, of course, focusing on the United States. That question was not generally seen in the discussions that I listened to and read and took part in at my own university. It was not generally seen as an ethical issue. It was seen rather as, perhaps to some extent, a question of what's in the interest of the United States, and to some extent a question of what's it politically realistic to expect either this particular administration, whichever administration that might be, whether it was the Clinton administration or subsequently the Bush administration, what it might be realistic to expect them to do or to expect them to be able to get through Congress. It seemed to be clear that it is an ethical issue, and I should say when I talk about this, I'm a little diffident in doing so in the presence of Dale Jamieson, who's been writing about this issue from an ethical perspective from long before I did. But I felt it was important to try again to make this argument, to make it for as wide an audience as I could. Because clearly it doesn't take very long to think about the issue to see that it really is a question of dividing up a shared resource the resource in this case is the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb waste gases. Right? So you can think of it, if you like, as a sink, as a drain down which you're going to pour your wastes. And if you imagine using a drain, you imagine it's being used collectively, let's say a whole village that just has one drain down which to pour your wastes, then it's easy to imagine that this drain has a limited capacity, and that if there are no limits to the amount of wastes that can be produced by any individual villager and then poured down this drain, at some point the capacity of the drain to cope with the waste being poured down will be exceeded, and it will become blocked, not be able to cleanse and deal with the waste, and we can assume that there will be some harmful consequences to the entire village. Perhaps the water supply will be polluted or something of that sort. So if you imagine that situation, then it's obvious that there are ethical questions about how you divide the capacity of the drain between the different villages. Different ways in which you might carve that up, and I'm going to look at that in a moment. And that's clearly an ethical question. Well, I think the capacity of the atmosphere to cope with our waste gases is a very similar situation. Something where, yes, you can put more waste gases in the atmosphere, but if you do, there will be harmful consequences to all of us. Admittedly, more harmful to some than to others, but certainly unpredictable consequences for all of us, because, as I think scientists have now fairly clearly established, there will be changes in our climate. The average tendency of these changes will be a significant increase in average global temperature over the next century. That will lead to different rainfall patterns, for example. Some areas that are now have adequate rainfall will have less than adequate rainfall. It will also lead to ecological changes as climate warms. Some species will simply become extinct because they have nowhere to go. Some species may be able to follow the climate changes and migrate towards the poles, away from the equator as it becomes warmer. But, for example, species that live near the tops of mountains are going to have nowhere further up to go. And in Australia, for instance, there are many unique alpine species of plants and animals that exist nowhere else on Earth. They already exist on the highest levels of the mountains, because Australian mountains are only a little over 2,000 metres high, and there is nowhere else in Australia for them to go. If those areas cease to get any winter snowfall, for instance, then those species will cease to exist. So there are ecological consequences like that. And, of course, there is also expected to be a rise in sea levels, which will inundate low-lying areas of land in many countries, particularly those countries that do not have the resources to build extensive seawalls and defend themselves against it. And among those regions are heavily populated areas like the Delta region of Bangladesh, which is home to perhaps 40 million people living on very low-lying land, which is very fertile because it contains the soil that's been washed down by the rivers. So it's very intensively farmed, but much of it is only about a meter above sea level. And already, if you get storms and high tides in the Bay of Bengal, you can get extensive flooding. So if the sea level rises 30 centimeters, for example, that will make that situation very much worse and will probably render millions or tens of millions of people homeless. So these are some of the consequences of global warming. And the question therefore arises, what should be done about this? Now, Of course, one thing has been done by most of the developed nations in the world, virtually all, and that is to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. But of course not all, and conspicuously the single biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, the United States, which is also, of course, has the highest per capita rate of emissions, has not signed on. So I think there's a very serious question here about the obligations of nations to do something about this. I should say that I think that the Kyoto Protocol itself is not really a treaty based on an ethical principle of allocation of those quotas, although I certainly think it's better than doing nothing, and for reasons I'll come to more fully, I think it's totally reprehensible in the United States not even to support the Kyoto Protocol. It's not something that one would defend from sort of ethical first principles. At best, you could say it was a kind of pragmatic compromise as to what should be done. All right, let's have a look at how one might address this question. Of course, this is very brief because I want to cover a number of other topics today as well, and I want to do that within the hour so that Dale has plenty of time for his talk. But if we ask how should we deal with this question, then I think that there are various possible principles of justice that could apply. Philosophers have sometimes divided principles of justice into two different types of principles. I think the clearest way of marking this division was made by Robert Nozick in his book Anarchy, State and Utopia, when he distinguished between what he called historical principles of justice and patent principles of justice. So a historical principle of justice looks at the history. How did we get to where we are now? And derives principles of justice from that history. Whereas a patent principle of justice looks at the pattern of distribution at a particular moment, a particular time slice, and says, is this a fair or just pattern of distribution? So I'll say a little bit about both of those views as they apply to climate change. The historical principles would basically say, I think, how did we get to this situation and who's responsible for it? And by this situation, I mean a situation in which we are considering having to, or we have to, restrain emissions of greenhouse gases in order to avoid catastrophe. Well, the way in which we got to this situation clearly is through the greenhouse emissions of past human activity, which were overwhelmingly produced in the developed nations. That is, were overwhelmingly produced in Western and Central Europe, and in the United States. These are the countries that have put most of the carbon dioxide that is now in the atmosphere, that have put it there, because carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for up to around a century. So we're talking about the last century of intensive industrial use with considerable greenhouse emissions by the developed nations. And that's actually what's led to the situation that we now have. So it's the developed nations that have caused the problem. And if you look at it in terms of a historical principle, then the principle you might consider is one that is often put colloquially as, if you broke it, then you should fix it. So there's no doubt that it's the developed nations that have caused the problem overwhelmingly, and they're the ones that, on this historical principle, I think, would have to do the primary task of fixing it. So what that means is that it does seem sound on that principle anyway, to say that it's the developed nations rather than the developing nations which should be doing the most about it. And so in that sense, since the Kyoto Principle binds the developed nations rather than the developing nations, that seems fair. And that's a contrast to something that George Bush has said when he said that he, in speaking about Kyoto, he thought that it was not fair because it didn't bind China and India, he specifically named. And he thought that was not an even-handed approach to the problem. But if the principle is you broke it, you fix it, then certainly it's the developed nations that have done much more in creating the problem. And while certainly eventually to be effective, we would need to bring China and India on board, they could well feel that they are not as responsible for the problem as the developed nations are. Then, if we might say, well, okay, that would be a historical principle, but it's better not to use historical principles, it's better to actually look at the present pattern of distribution. The question is, do we get any different outcome from doing that? I've been putting forward in these talks a utilitarian approach, as you know, and the utilitarian approach would basically say, well, we should try to have the outcome that has the best consequences. But what would that be? Well, I think clearly the outcome that has the best consequences would be one that does not lead to the disastrous consequences that I mentioned before for people who are trying to farm areas where rainfall will become more erratic or less predictable, or where sea levels are going to rise and inundate their farmlands. So certainly on a utilitarian view, you would try to do something about this situation. And then the next question is, well, who should really be acting to do something about it? And the answer would probably be those who must make the least sacrifice for the most consequences, for the best consequences. Now, in one sense, that might mean that the cuts should be made as effectively as possible. And that's an argument, perhaps, for, as some have suggested, developing a market in permits to emit. So that if you decide on the kind of level of global emissions that the world can sustain without these disastrous consequences, and then you divide that up, you might then allocate that, but we need to discuss how you allocate it, which I'll come to in a moment. But once you've allocated it, to allow trading in these permits so that those who can reduce emissions most cheaply will have an incentive to do so, because they will then have spare emission permits that can be traded. Those who can only reduce emissions themselves at a high cost will purchase permits from those who can reduce them more cheaply. So I think for utilitarian reasons, there is an argument to defend the idea that once you decide how you allocate permits for emissions, you should be able to trade them between different nations. The usual economic efficiencies of the market, basically, applying here. But the prior question is, how do you allocate these permits? Roughly what Kyoto does, if you think of that as a permit system, it's not exactly that, but it certainly includes an element of that within those nations that are taking part. What Kyoto does is to look at how much nations were emitting in 1990, just to sort of more or less arbitrarily chosen base year, and then say, well, you need to get to an agreed level below that. And roughly the agreed level is usually 5% below that, although in some nations it's more and in some nations it's less. So that's a way of basically just taking the status quo or the past practice and saying you have to get a certain step below that. Now, that might have been politically defensible, but there's no particular reason why the fact that a nation committed a lot in 1990 should give it a right to commit a lot in 2003, oil and gas. In fact, as I said, looking at the historic principle, you could even argue that the reverse of the case, that the fact that a particular nation has been causing this problem is a reason for saying that they should reduce even more sharply than other nations that have not been causing so much of the problem. But by putting that aside, it's hard to see why the capacity of the Earth to absorb greenhouse gases should be allocated so that one nation gets more of it than another, even though their populations are the same. Or, to put that question another way, why shouldn't we simply say that since the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb greenhouse gases is a common resource, everyone on Earth has prima facie equal right to their share of it. So if you take that way of looking at it, then you would take the total amount that the atmosphere can absorb, and you would divide it by 6 billion roughly, and you would get a per capita notional entitlement, and then you would say, okay, well, what's your population? If your population is 25 million, you have 25 million times the notional per capita allowance. If your population is 800 million or whatever, you have that, and so on and so forth. And in terms of just basic justice or fairness, it's hard to see why that isn't the best way of allocating this shared resource. There are some potential problems with it, but I think that they can be addressed. And so what you would then have is a situation in which the developed nations have actually considerably exceeded their quotas, whereas the countries that Bush mentioned, China and India, have not. China is getting close to its quota, depending exactly how you measure it, but it doesn't seem to have exceeded it as yet. India is perhaps only at about a third of its quota, so it would have a long way to go. So the kind of system that I'm suggesting, as I say very briefly, is the fairest, the ethical way of approaching the situation would be a notional per capita share of the possible tolerable global greenhouse emissions, allocated to nations in accordance with their population, and then with the proviso that they're allowed to trade their permits. And that would have an interesting effect, which fits in with what we were talking about yesterday. It would mean that the rich developed nations, which have become rich in part because of their use of this common resource, would actually have to buy quota from the developing nations that have used very little of this resource. So that India, for example, would have a very large amount of quota to sell, given that it's only only used about a third of its quota, and that it has a very large population. Some other nations would have even more to sell in proportion to their population. Ethiopia, for example, is around 1% of its quota on this scale. On the other hand, the United States would have to buy an enormous amount of quota because it's about 5 times over its quota at present. And the nations of the European Union would also have to buy quota. They average something like 2.5 to 3 times their quota, much better than the United States, but still well over their quota. So this would in fact mean a transfer from the wealthier nations to the poorer nations, which in general is, as I say, in line with what I think ought to happen for other reasons, although there would be questions about making sure that the transfer actually goes to help those nations rather than simply to prop up a corrupt government. So there are some questions about how that should be done, but in principle, that seems to me to be a more ethical approach to the issue of climate change than the Kyoto Protocol itself takes, and of course a far more ethical approach than that the Bush administration has taken, which is basically to say, the American right to drive there because is part of the American way of life. This is kind of a sacred right of Americans, and we're not going to reduce it or limit it in any coercive way at all. So the administration has introduced these kind of voluntary guidelines, which effectively do nothing, and all the statistics show that American greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise in a fairly steady way. So that really, I think this is simply a case of national selfishness imposing the cost on the rest of the world because they don't have to do anything else. Okay, so that's an example of a global problem where there has not so far really been a conscious ethical approach to the issues, but I believe there should be. Now, of course, you might say, well, that's pretty utopian to expect that to happen. Yes, in a way it is. I don't sort of expect political leaders immediately to sort of simply look at this ethical argument and say, okay, we must do that. But if we don't have a public that understands this as an ethical issue and debates it that way, then of course we're never going to get political leaders to think of it that way. If we have a better informed public, there is some chance that in the long run people will start to think about these issues differently. Alright, the next thing I'll briefly say a few words about is about the trade issues that causes this controversy about the World Trade Organization, starting back in Seattle and subsequently at more or less every meeting of the ministers of the World Trade Organization, except I think the one that was held in Doha in the Persian Gulf state of Qatar last year, where I guess none of the would-be demonstrators could get visas to go there, so that was quite an effective way of having a peaceful meeting. There are a lot of issues here, and really it's hard to deal with them briefly. But let me just say this. One of the ethical issues about the WTO and its actions, I think that there are a number. One question is whether economic globalization, trade liberalization, is itself a good thing or a bad thing. That's clearly an ethical issue. A very large ethical issue with a huge amount of factual and theoretical discussion that has to go into deciding it. But ultimately, we are talking about whether something is good or bad, order or not to take place. And to look at that, you have to look at the criteria for deciding what's good or bad. And much of the debate about that has been in terms of whether the WTO arrangements make the world more or less equal. But I think, in fact, this question needs to be broken up a little bit. And certainly from a utilitarian perspective, it's not really equality in itself that ought to be decisive. Because the world could be becoming less equal even while everyone in it is becoming better off. Okay, that's one possible scenario. I'm not saying that is the current scenario, but it's possible that, for example, due to economic liberalization, the welfare levels, we should be talking about welfare, although usually these things are talked about in terms of income, but of course income is not an exact correlate with welfare, although it has something to do with it, but it's possible that because of economic liberalization, the best off 10% of the population have experienced a rise in their welfare of 100% over the last two decades, let's say, of economic liberalization. And the lowest 10% have experienced a rise in their welfare of only 20%, I'd say. Now, if that's so, then the gap between rich and poor is becoming greater. And many people may say that's deplorable. But while it may be deplorable, because it may not be the best outcome, it may still be a better outcome than the previous one, where the gap between rich and poor was narrower, but the poor were still worse off than they are now. So from a utilitarian perspective, you really want to look at welfare rather than inequality as such. But having said that, you do want to pay particular attention to the welfare levels of the worst off, because that's often where you can make the most difference, especially if we're talking about things that distribute income. As I think I already mentioned once in these talks, if someone is earning $100,000 and you give them an extra $1,000 or even an extra $10,000, you've probably made a relatively small difference to their welfare. If someone is earning $10,000 a year and you give them an extra $1,000, you've probably made a significant difference. If you give them an extra $10,000, you've made a huge difference to their welfare. So we do need to pay attention to the worst off, particularly. And so we can move to a somewhat different question about economic liberalisation. Has it made the worst off better off at all? That is, in absolute standards of living, not in relative welfare. And that's actually a much more difficult question to answer empirically than many people think. There's been a lot of polemics in the debate about the WTO and economic liberalisation on both sides. And the polemic that you get from the anti-globalisation side certainly suggests that the worst off have become even worse off in absolute terms than they were. But as I said, that is really difficult to show in terms of any economic statistics or figures that exist. It's partly simply a problem of getting good data. We have data about average per capita income, about average GDP for nations, and we can look at the GDP of the poorest nations, and we can say that it's not rising, and in some cases it's even fallen. That's true. That, though, doesn't tell you much about what's going on inside the country. That is, whether within the country that fall has been a fall in the more wealthy elite of that country, in which case it may not reduce welfare very much, especially if there's been a rise in the lowest within that country, or whether it's been evenly distributed across all income levels, in which case it will be hurting the poor, or even focus more on the poor, in which case it will be hurting them still more. So really we don't have a lot of data to answer that question. From the data that we do have and that I've looked at, it might be possible to say that yes, the poorest 10% of the world have become a little worse off, but if you go to a larger fraction of the poor, say the poorest 30%, they seem to have become better off. In other words, economic liberalisation has benefited some of the poor, but the segment of the poor that it seems to have benefited, as I say, it seems because the data is not very good, seems to have benefited is not those who are really at the bottom, who don't seem able to take advantage of economic liberalisation, but those who are a bit above the bottom, who have been able to take more advantage of it, have been able to participate in the industries that sell into the global economy. And have improved. So there's an ethical question then as to whether you are prepared to accept a deal, an arrangement, that improves the level, the average level of the bottom 30%, but actually causes a deterioration in the level of the bottom 10%. And from a utilitarian or welfarist perspective, that's pretty difficult to calculate, because it may well be that even though the bottom 10% is a smaller number than the bottom 30%, of course, they are suffering more because they are already closer to the margins at which they can survive. So So, I say that simply to say that's a complicated question and one that is difficult to really be confident about in terms of the data that we have at present. Another issue that has been raised about the World Trade Organization is that it puts economic values ahead of all other values, including particularly environmental values. You might remember in Seattle, there were these demonstrators dressed up as turtles to make the point that the World Trade Organization had struck down an attempt by the United States to protect sea turtles by refusing to import shrimp caught by ships that did not fit what are called turtle exclusion devices, that is, devices that stop turtles being fouled in their nets, and which were threatening the extinction of sea turtles, certainly killing many of them unnecessarily. And the United States was not being discriminatory in this case. Sometimes it has been, but in this case it was not being discriminatory against foreign nations. It was requiring its own shrimp fishing fleet to fit these devices as well. So, in terms of what you read about WTO ideology, which simply says we want to eliminate protection that protects a nation's own industries, there seems to be no reason for the WTO to strike down this law about protecting sea turtles. But nevertheless it did. So that was why there were these protests. And this followed an earlier case of something rather similar about tuna and dolphin, tuna fisheries fishing in a way that didn't kill dolphin. And generally it is true that where issues involving environmental protection laws have come before the World Trade Organization, they have been struck down. And there are a lot of problems with this, problems that may relate to what I talked about with animals a few days ago, because the European Union, as I said, has now passed certain laws regarding the confinement of farm animals, like factory hens and pigs and cows. And the question is, will they be able to stop the import of these products from countries that still allow these methods? And again, if you simply think that the World Trade Organization is about not unfairly protecting your own industry, then Europe should be able to allow, should be able to prevent these products produced by methods too cruel to be allowed within Europe to prevent them being imported. But it's still not clear whether that will be possible under the WTO rules. There are ongoing discussions about possible changes, which have not yet progressed very far. They were started by, put on the agenda by the Doha meeting last year. What the WTO says about this is that laws to exclude products must be based on the nature of the product, not the process by which the product was produced. So that, in other words, what they're saying is, if you want to keep out an egg produced by a hen in a cage that would not be legal in Europe, you have to show that that egg is different from an egg produced by a hen kept in a way that is legal in Europe. It's not just a matter of saying, well, this egg was produced by a cruel process and this egg was produced by a more humane process, and that's why we're keeping out the egg produced by the cruel process if we want to object to cruelty. You have to actually show that the egg is somehow different. It's the product, not the process, under WTO jurisprudence. And that's, I think, the real problem, and that's what needs to be changed. That's a kind of a case law that has developed out of WTO decisions and out of prior decisions of GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, to which the WTO is the successor organization. To address the current global political situation, as well as the issues that I talked about in a book that was finished over a year ago, I guess. So, obviously there are recent developments that I couldn't really tackle. First though, let me just sort of state the general question that I want to look at. And this is, as part of becoming one world, a more globalized community, we have had parallel with developments towards a global economy and global awareness of the fact that we share a common atmosphere. We have also had the beginnings of a rethinking of the idea of national sovereignty. Now, the system of national sovereignty under which the world has basically been living throughout the last 300 years or so is the one handed down by the Treaty of Westphalia, ending the 30 Years' War in Europe, which recognized the idea of national sovereignty and as of the rights of sovereigns to really to absolute jurisdiction within their own territory without interference from outside, without interference from other nations outside. So that was a system of a strong idea of national sovereignty and the idea that what goes on in another country is basically no one else's business except the sovereign government of that country. So that includes questions about the constitution of that government, whether it's a democracy, whether it's a monarchy, whether it's a tyranny, a dictator, or whatever, and questions about how that government treats its own subjects. And that's the system under which the world existed, pretty much unchallenged, maybe not totally unchallenged, but fairly largely unchallenged, up to the end of the Second World War, when the Allies decided to try the Axis leaders, most famously, of course, the Nazi leaders, but also the Japanese leaders, for war crimes, not only for the crime of aggressively making war, which was what the original idea of the Nuremberg trial was about, for breaches of international treaties and aggressively making war, but more or less as an afterthought, Roosevelt decided that Nuremberg should also try the Nazis for crimes that they had committed to their own populations and the populations of subjugated countries, essentially, largely the Jews and the Gypsies, the Holocaust. And so that set a precedent of the idea that national governments and the people running them are responsible for crimes that they commit, or at least for some extreme crimes that they commit, crimes of genocide, which were held to be contrary to natural law. And the defense that the Nazi leaders had acted in accordance with the laws of Germany at the time when they were acting was not considered a sound defense because of this violation of natural law. So that set a significant precedent, although one that largely remained unused for quite a long time because really of the Cold War, I guess, in that situation, which prevented any kind of international cooperation in developing these principles. But then, with the end of the Cold War, there started to be a little more interest in some of these questions. And particularly the tragic genocide in Rwanda was a kind of stimulus for thinking about this again. And that stimulus was acknowledged by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who actually was involved in on the United Nations department, the desk that was looking after Rwanda in that part of the time, and who felt unable to act, perhaps himself regretting not having taken a stronger lead, but was certainly hampered by the refusal of other nations, including the United States under the Clinton administration, to act promptly and decisively to forestall that attack, that genocide. And then subsequently we got the developing situation of former Yugoslavia in Bosnia and in Kosovo, where in Bosnia very belatedly there was some UN intervention, and in Kosovo rather more early there was NATO intervention, not United Nations intervention, because the difficulties of getting Russia to support it at the Security Council at least in part. And that led to a kind of a dilemma, I guess, a system saying, well, Yes, on the one hand, this kind of humanitarian intervention seems to be a good thing if it prevents these crimes, but on the other hand, could it lead to excuses for war which reduce the barriers against going to war? And Kofi Annan, in a 1999 speech, referred to exactly this dilemma and says, well, on the one hand, if you look at the situation in Rwanda, he says, if in those dark days and hours leading up to the genocide, a coalition of states had been prepared to act in defense of the Tutsi population, but did not receive prompt council authorization, should such a coalition have stood aside and allowed the horror to unfold? So he's suggesting basically rhetorically, well, if the council had not been prompt to authorize intervention, surely it would have been good for any coalition of states to go ahead and intervene to prevent that genocide. But then he goes on to say, is there not a converse danger, looking at the situation in Kosovo, where exactly that happened, is there not a danger of such interventions undermining the imperfect yet resilient security system created after the Second World War, and of setting dangerous precedents for future interventions without a clear criterion to decide who might invoke these precedents and in what circumstances? And I think Annan has there very well outlined the dilemma about humanitarian intervention, that on the one hand, you don't want nations to stand by and let hundreds of thousands of people perhaps be killed, and on the other hand, you don't want precedent set to allow nations to go to war where humanitarian intervention really is an excuse for intervening in another country's affairs, having more influence in that country, perhaps having some other advantages, rather than the real reason for the intervention. Well, what's the solution to this? I think that there is a strong argument saying that humanitarian intervention without the authorization of some international global body does set dangerous precedents. Which is not to say, and it would be difficult to say within a utilitarian framework, that it should never occur, that we can never imagine a situation in which intervention would be justified without UN approval, but that one should be very, very cautious in using that, and should be really sure that this is the only way to stop a major atrocity. The other side of the coin is that the United Nations should really be reformed in order to enable it to act more promptly and more decisively. And, of course, if we look at the way the United Nations is structured, and really here particularly we're talking about the Security Council, because the General Assembly isn't the kind of body that can authorize actions of this kind. The United Nations Security Council is a legacy of the Second World War in ways that have started to become, I think, obsolete. That is, the Security Council has these permanent five members who are the victors of the Second World War. Britain, France, the United States, China, and what's now Russia. There's really no good reason that I can see beyond inertia as to why, for example, Britain and France should be members of the permanent members of the Security Council. And of course, the permanent members have a veto if they vote against any action that can't take place. So there's no good reason I can see why Britain and France should be members of the permanent members of the Security Council, whereas Brazil or India or Indonesia or Japan are not members. They're nations with, all of them, nations with significantly larger populations than either Britain or France, and it's hard to see why they should have a smaller role. So maybe, in fact, what we need to do is to move away from the idea of permanent members and veto powers altogether, and rather have rotating or elected membership with some requirement for a special majority in order to make sure that it doesn't act precipitously. So rather than having a veto system that one nation can block action, we should have a system that perhaps a three-quarters majority of the members is needed, or a two-thirds majority, something of that sort, to restrict Security Council action. But I think that within those terms, humanitarian intervention can be justified. And again, you can have to talk about further procedures, which I won't go into, to ensure that there is accurate information about the situation that's unfolding and so on. You could also imagine, though it looks further into the future, the idea that the United Nations then does not need to call on its member nations to send in forces, but actually has sufficient forces of its own to act on that basis to prevent humanitarian atrocities in many different, in different countries. So I think that that would be a better solution overall to the problems that we face with humanitarian intervention. I now want to turn for a few minutes to more recent developments in the world and look at arguments about those interventions. I'm thinking here, of course, particularly of the United States' actions over Iraq, and that is part of a shift in American policy as to how it sees global affairs, which I think has been a fairly marked shift between the Clinton administration and the post-September 11, 2001 Bush administration. I say post-September 11 because although we can certainly see that some members of the Bush administration have consistently pursued the same policies from before September 11 and after, the administration as a whole, I think, has changed course, and it has accepted a different way of looking at the world and global affairs from that which either Clinton accepted or Bush himself spoke about in his pre-election statements as a candidate, or for that matter, to some extent anyway, what he did before September 11. There's definitely a shift between Clinton and Bush even before September 11, but a bigger one after. Well, let me quote you as an example of what I see being this new policy, a passage from a speech that Bush made at the graduation ceremony in West Point. West Point is the United States Military Academy that trains the elite officers of the U.S. Army. Not all of the U.S. Army officers, but it's considered the most prestigious and best one, and so many of them. Bush was addressing many of the future leaders of the U.S. military in June last year, almost exactly a year ago. He said, "We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge. In the world we have entered, the only path to safety is the path of action, and this nation will act. America has and intends to keep military strength beyond challenge, thereby making the destabilizing arms races of other eras pointless and limiting rivalries to trade and other pursuits of peace." Now, I think there's two different key ideas in those remarks, which are elaborated on a bit during the speech itself. The first one is the idea that America will act. And by that, clearly, Bush means America will act preemptively. America will not wait to be attacked. America will attack first. And the second statement is that America intends to keep military strength beyond challenge, thereby asserting the doctrine that has become known by those right supporters as the doctrine of American preeminence. So I want to say a little bit about these two, as I see, the two key features of the new Bush policy. Firstly, the right to preemptive strike. If you look at this in terms of international law historically, there has been a right to preemptive strikes accepted in international law, but only in very, very specific circumstances. In fact, it was a United States Secretary of State in the 19th century who elaborated this doctrine in a case where the British attacked an American ship that was aiding rebels in Canada. The doctrine that the American Secretary of State put out in saying the British had acted wrongly was that the right to preemptive strikes occurs only when there is an imminent danger of attack. In other words, the point was this ship was not about to attack you. This ship was admittedly carrying weapons to help rebels, but was not about to attack you. But clearly, what Bush is doing is saying that that's no longer a doctrine that we're prepared to accept. And his argument for that, which is not a stupid argument, I think, is that technology has changed the nature of warfare. And that whereas previously you could have a strictly limited doctrine of preemption, the right to preemptive attack, that was because the enemy could not inflict overwhelming damage on you without you having significant warning that this would occur. That is, if you take the First World War situation, for example, the armies of Russia and Germany took weeks to mobilize before that situation, they could actually be ready to go to war. You would have warning that an attack was imminent, and you could then, if you were going to strike preemptively, do so when an attack really was imminent, and you would not miss out on it. But, as Bush said, the perilous crossroads, as he called it, of radicalism and technology mean that it is theoretically possible for someone to have weapons which can kill hundreds of thousands or millions, and you may have no prior warning of that strike. That's the argument. So Bush is saying that since America's enemies, Al-Qaeda I guess is particularly thinking of there, have declared their intention to strike at America, to do what they can to damage America and its citizens, and since, he said, they've been seeking weapons of mass destruction, so the right to preemptive strike must be changed in order to allow America to strike first. Well, as I say, that's not a stupid doctrine or a stupid argument. It does seem to be true that the situation that in which the 19th century right of preemptive strike was recognized is something that situation has changed. But the question still arises as to how this can be an international or universal right to preemptive strike when you're threatened, and how you could have a system of global peacekeeping in which that is the case. Because if indeed the United States asserts that there is a right to attack those who threaten to attack you, and those who have weapons of mass destruction at their disposal, then, for example, it seems fairly obvious that North Korea at present has a right to make a preemptive strike against the United States, because certainly the United States has threatened North Korea, certainly the United States has weapons of mass destruction at its disposal. It's no doubt true that it would be completely stupid of North Korea to attack the United States because they could not attack it with sufficient force to destroy the ability of the United States to counterattack with overwhelming force against North Korea. So this is not likely to happen. This could not be a rational action. But in terms of asserting a general right of preemptive strike, it does apply more widely. Again, it would have applied to Iraq before the United States attacked it, when it was obvious that it was planning to do so. So the problem there is that it's hard to see this as being a general right. And in fact, it's hard to see how one could assert that as a universal kind of argument. And if you look at the American debate, sometimes it's assumed that, well, it's the good nations that have the right to attack the bad nations preemptively, not the other way around. And of course, we all know that Iraq and North Korea are part of the axis of evil, so therefore they're the bad nations and we're the good nations. But how you actually define the good and bad nations in this way is something that no one has really said. Again, it's part of the rhetoric of the Bush administration that the United States is a democracy, and that might be seen as part of what makes a nation good as against another nation. But, well, how one defines exactly a democracy is another question. It's possible that a democratic nation could, in fact, support international terrorism or something like that. I mean, it's certainly not totally possible that democratic elections in an Islamic nation might bring a regime that supports Al-Qaeda or something of that sort. So it doesn't seem that it's really democracy that is going to be the crucial event here. So there are no real criteria, I think, that have been put forward to suggest exactly what, how this idea of preemptive strike could be used. So I think that, in fact, you can't simply have such a vague right to preemptive strike as a basis for international relations and peacekeeping. And if you have this belief in the justifiability of preemptive strikes and a refusal to accept any kind of international institutions that can decide when there is a real overwhelming danger, then it seems that there is not really a moral basis for international relationships anymore. But that leads us, and I don't want to take much longer, you know, we want to have some discussion before we break for Dale's talk, and that leads us with the alternative, which I think is in fact part of the general idea of American preeminence, and that is that instead of thinking of international relations as a kind of moral arena, which, if you wanted to talk about it philosophically, you might link with Kant's famous idea of a global federation and an arrangement for achieving perpetual peace. It's not really the Kantian model that the architects of the United States foreign policy had in mind. It's rather a Hobbesian model. It's the model of Thomas Hobbes, which says, as indeed Hobbes explicitly said, we are in a state of nature at the international level, not within a sovereign nation, but internationally we are in a state of nature. A state of nature is a very bad situation to be in because it creates insecurity, and the fear that you may be attacked creates a rational justification for attacking first. That's exactly the doctrine of the preemptive strike, of course, working in a spiraling sort of effect. But the solution in Hobbes' philosophy to getting out of the state of nature is to have an overwhelmingly powerful sovereign who can punish anyone who breaches the peace. And I think essentially the architects of American foreign policy are influenced by this Hobbesian idea and by the idea that it's the United States that should play the role of the sovereign, not the United Nations. The United Nations, they dismiss strongly, for example, in the language of Richard Perle, influential advisor to the Defense Department and to Rumsfeld, they dismiss the United Nations as weak, as ineffectual, as too influenced by nations that are not democracies, and so on. And therefore say it's only the United States that can actually play this role. And I think, in fact, when talking about Hobbes, it's not really just, it's not totally an accident, in fact, that there is this Hobbesian view. It's significant that quite a number of influential people in the current Bush administration are in a group loosely known as Straussians, that is, followers of the philosopher, thinker, Leo Strauss, who came to the United States from Europe in the 20s and 30s, and wrote a number of works of philosophy influenced by the need to prevent tyranny and so on, and did write an interesting book on the philosophy of Thomas Hobbes. And sort of gave rise through his teaching more than through explicit doctrines to a kind of loose coterie of people who have been influenced by his thinking and by other professors who themselves were influenced by him. And as I say, that includes a number of the influential people like Paul Wolfowitz in the Defense Department and Richard Perle, Rumsfeld, William Crystal, who is not a member of the administration, but has been a key figure in a group called the Project for the New American Century. You can find their website on the web, which even before Bush came to power, so even before 2000, was asserting that the 21st century should be the century of American preeminence, and it was asserting that the United States needed to boost its defense spending, although at that stage there was no great threat to it, in order to ensure its military superiority. And you can actually find documents on that website, as I say, predating September 11th, advocating the need for the United States to remove Saddam Hussein from power. So I think this is a strand of thought which has existed with some people for a long time, although they may not have been able to exert their influence to get the United States government to follow their policies had it not been for the events of September 11th, which gave a pretext, I would say, for the actions that we saw take place more recently. That has made it easier to gain public support for a war removing Saddam. Because large numbers of Americans actually believed, without any evidence, that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And of course, even more, in fact, an overwhelming majority of Americans believed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction that he was ready to use, which we are starting to see that seems to be rather unlikely. So that, I think, is the sort of the philosophical choices, in a way, that are playing out between a Hobbesian view of world affairs in which the United States plays the role of the sovereign and a more Kantian view in which we rather see a kind of world federation to keep the peace based on ethical principles rather than on sheer power, and hope to reform the United Nations in a way to make it an effective body to do that. And on this particular issue, although I'm not in general philosophically, as you may have noticed, a supporter of Kant, I would take sides, I would side with Kant, with a Kantian perspective on this, that in the long run, it seems to me to be better for the world as a whole if we have some sort of international system in which all nations can participate and can feel that they can play a role, rather than an international system that is dominated by one nation, which we can be fairly sure will consider its own interests as much as it considers the interests of global peacekeeping, if not more. Okay, let me start at that point. I think, again, we won't take a break now, right? We'll go straight into the discussion, and then we'll take a debate. Then we'll take a break before we go into Dale's talk.
So you said last week last week, I'm very concerned about environmental subjects and the ethics for this in relation of this subject. I thought after your lectures, I thought that there are moral rules in the impact, in the environmental impact that we are living nowadays, as you have said today as well. Beginning by this situation where there is a separation, a division between, a division between what we can do with nature and we should, and what we should do. I don't know if I'm clear enough. This separation which leads with addresses to consider nature just as an object instead of as a subject which can produce values and which is which produces values. And in this case, the technique which has been used to transport nature with this sense of the nature as just an object has been overused, or we have abused of techniques, and we have made more deep. We have widened this division between what we should do and what we are able to do thanks science and techniques. Well, my question in this context of concerns is could we think that ethics should have a change, should it be a change of ethic paradigm, or is it just a question of extending the mark of the reflection? A deep change of paradigm, as it was the case in the times of Kant, as regards freedom, for example. In this case, do we need that philosophers and thinkers think and reflect over these subjects from new points of view, or is just a matter of extend these issues to the same ethical system? That's one of the questions. Maybe I'll do some others after your
after I respond. Okay. Well, I think you've raised a good issue, but I think it's really very difficult to have a totally new ethical paradigm. And specifically, if you're talking about the idea of regarding nature as an ethical subject, I think it's difficult for the reasons that I talked about, I can't remember now, maybe in the second or third talk that I gave, to regard nature as a whole as an ethical subject. I mean, I certainly think that we can extend ethics beyond humans to non-human animals. I certainly think that we can insist on taking a long-range view, on considering the interests of future generations, more or less indefinitely into the future, subject to discounting for uncertainty about what they will want and so on. But I don't think we can regard nature as a whole as an ethical subject, because nature as a whole is not a conscious being and doesn't really have interests. And if you put it in put yourself in the position of nature, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So I think you have to separate things out. I mean, I think it's It's okay to use some elements of nature as an object. If we need building materials, it's okay to quarry rocks out of nature. Of course, not everywhere. There are many places you would want to protect nature and forests and so on from being quarried, but I don't think that in itself that's necessarily the wrong thing to do. It all depends on the circumstances. It depends on the extent to which we are damaging other sentient creatures, the extent to which we are causing possible harm to ourselves through pollution, the extent to which we are eliminating lasting values that we can expect to appeal to future generations, like scenic values of landscape and so on. All of those things are relevant, but they seem to be relevant because of the interests of particular sentient beings who live either now or will live in the future, not because there is such a thing as nature as such to whom we owe ethical obligations.
Well, I agree with you in the point of what is matter nowadays is the extent we are abusing. We are using nature, the transformations of nature has been nowadays in such extension that has created this environmental impact just in the last 50 years. It's not more than 50 years. So we can imagine, we should imagine, the planet has lived for 4 billions of years. And human species have damaged the natural evolution just in the last 50 years, which is very amazing, at least, we could say. So something is going wrong, really wrong. And of course, if we don't focus the problem as an ethical problem, we're not going to say, from the economic field, there is something to say and something to change, of course. And there is a new field of reflection in the economic field, which is ecological economy. The people who are working in social science, we are making these reflections as well in all these disciplines. But I am convinced that one of the more important approaches is philosophical approach, since from this point of view.
Well, absolutely, because I think, you know, even within the sort of the framework that I've sketched, to include the interests of sentient non-humans, to include fully the interests of future generations, to respect other values that will be timeless rather than short-sighted economic ones, is going to be extremely important in understanding how we deal with all of these questions. So totally, I agree that there are important philosophical aspects of anything that deals with economics and ecology.
Talk about the responsibility or obligation of men, of nations, but could you talk a little bit more about responsibility as a moral value of individuals in these concerns?
Well,
or would you consider responsibility as a moral value as a solution to environmental problems?
I consider responsibility as a utilitarian would, as not an intrinsic moral value, but as something that is instrumental to obtaining the right results. So what we're focusing on is the outcome, and the question is, who must we hold responsible for what in order to achieve the right outcome? So, for example, I think the concept of responsibility is very important for what I was talking about with regard to global warming. And although I didn't particularly use that language, I think it would have been very easy to cast what I said into the language of saying, what's happened up to now is that people who are emitting, responsible for emitting greenhouse gases, have not seen themselves as responsible for the alterations in climate patterns and the rise in sea levels on the other side of the world. And now they must start to see themselves as responsible. So that if, for example, you have a choice between purchasing a vehicle that emits, that uses a lot of fuel and emits a lot of greenhouse gases, or one of the newer generation of relatively clean cars that is that uses very small amounts of fuel and emits very few greenhouse gases, then you have to think about your own responsibility for contributing to the change in climate. So just as yesterday when we talked about both the role of governments in foreign aid and what one can do as individuals, there is a question as to what you can do as individuals in order to reduce your emission as well, which there can be individual responsibility and there can be government responsibility for setting these policies. And so yes, there are those issues. And the question is then always, well, we can't actually achieve solutions unless we realize that individuals are responsible for these consequences and we find mechanisms for persuading them to change their actions. So the concept of responsibility is something which we need to decide who is to be held morally responsible for what. And obviously that will relate to causal responsibility or to the possibility of preventing something that is causal responsibility through emissions to act can also be relevant. And yes, that's very important, and I think that's one of the problems with what the Bush administration is failing to do on climate change, is it's not really holding anyone responsible for the emissions that they produce. It's sort of issued some voluntary guidelines encouraging them to do something about it, but if they don't, there are no consequences, not in terms of the law, nor even in terms of particularly, you know, getting praised for good efforts or blamed for bad ones. So, yes, we need more of that concept as a means to achieve the ends.
And do you think we are responsible of our acts as well as of our emissions?
Yes, I do. I think we're responsible for emissions where we are conscious of the fact that, you know, or could reasonably become conscious of the fact that we are failing to do something that would have better consequences. So, of course, you know, we can't be held responsible for everything that we don't do if we have no knowledge that by doing something we could prevent a bad consequence. But once we have that knowledge, we're responsible. And then we ought to consider our choices as part of a package. A package that says, well, if I do this, then I don't do that. And there may be good things that I do by doing this, but what about the bad things that I don't bring about? Or what about the good things I fail to bring about by the emission, or the bad things I fail to prevent? And if you can see that, and if you have the choices, then certainly I think you are responsible for your emissions.
Yes, two questions. The first one would be related to your talk and the exhibition, the arguments you gave today. Sometimes it seemed to me you were talking about individuals. Sometimes you were talking about the nations. Nation responsibility or nation's actions, individuals' responsibility, individuals' actions. But, I mean, the weight of individuals and the weight of nations will vary with relation when it comes to, for example, China, or when it comes, for example, to Holland or Belgium or a small country. I mean, individuals and nations have different weight according to, with relation to the proportion, the ratio of its population, and this could have consequences when it comes to allocate, for example, the tolerable gas emissions. I mean, and what small nations could say to, for example, your principle of distribution you've put forward of a rent per capita gas emissions all over the world would be, well, we have a developed country and per capita we have per capita we would have a very high we would rate quite high in the scale, but and China or India would score quite low, and that would be unfair according to our history. So, and that could be an objection to your principle raised by these countries. I mean, we should take not only the fact that we have individuals, but also nations or countries with different populations. That would be.
Why should the fact that a nation is smaller give it a right to, or give its citizens a right to a larger share of the atmosphere? I mean, why should the fact that you're a citizen of Iceland, say, mean that you have a share of the atmosphere that is 10,000 times larger than if you're a citizen of India?
That's what I think that they would say, and I guess they would appeal to sovereignty reasons. The idea of what I'm trying to introduce into the argument is the idea of sovereignty related to the idea of nations.
Right.
And not only to states or a coordination of individuals organized in order to that's what I mean. A small nation would appeal not only to the fact that they are.
I mean, I think this is one of the. I don't accept this view of the sort of equal status of every sovereign nation. And actually, this is one of the points on which I agree with the American critics of the United Nations, that they say it accepts the principle of sovereign equality, which is really an absurd principle when you think of the idea that it gives the citizens of Iceland, I think there's 275,000 of them, as much influence at an international level. This isn't true, but it's kind of the theory of the General Assembly of the United Nations anyway. But the citizens of Iceland have as much influence as the citizens of India or China, with opinion inhabitants. I can't see that. I can't see why, for example, suppose that, and I know this could be popular here for other reasons, suppose that Spain decides to divide and Catalonia becomes an independent nation, the Basque country becomes an independent nation, Galicia, whatever, Andalusia, and so on. I can't see why Spain should then have 10 times as much influence at an international level as it has now, because it's become 10 separate nations rather than one. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me in terms of any ethical principles or fairness or anything of the sort. So I think, in fact, while we might want to recognize that every sovereign nation is in some way represented at the United Nations, if you're going to come to something like voting rights or like allocation of greenhouse gas emissions, I would have thought to say that that's in proportion to population makes a lot more sense than just saying that it's in proportion to the principle of sovereign equality.
But then aren't you leading to a one world country?
Yes. One global federation, if you like, is the ultimate direction in which this goes, with obviously various safeguards, hopefully against the global dominance, the protection of individual cultures. But I do think that there are global problems which can only be dealt with at that level, and they've become increasingly important because of issues of the fact that we've more or less used up the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb these gases, because of issues like improved communications, which gives us instant knowledge of what's happening in other places and almost instant capacity to respond. Because the trade economy has become more globalized, I think for that reason we do need to move towards something more like a global federal system. And that will take a long time to achieve or work out if it ever happens, but I do think it's a desirable direction to go in. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's second question was related to what you said about equality. I mean, which was quite brief and small. I'd like to you to go a little bit further, and particularly with what you said when you were talking about distributing resources between the worst off, or the ones who are a little better than the worst off. We could say maybe neoliberalization has helped above 30 worst off, but at least 10% worst off are still worst off. I mean, you said also that utilitarianism would have difficulties when it comes to saying whether it's better to help the 30% worst off or the 10% worst off. Wouldn't that be a problem for utilitarianism? I mean, if utilitarianism cannot deal with that, cannot tackle that question, maybe it is because utilitarianism has some kind of problems.
Well, but I didn't want to say that utilitarianism can't deal with the problem. I mean, it does have an answer to it, but it's not an answer that you can reach simply on the data that I gave you. That is, the fact that the 30% are better off and the 10% are worse off isn't enough information to reach a utilitarian answer. But if you had full information, then you would. And I mean, you could do it simply by summing the differences in welfare, so that if you have the the population of these groups, right? So let's say each of these boxes is 10%, right? And so this is the worst off 10%. This is the second worst off 10%. And this is the third worst off 10%, and so then what you've done is you've made the following changes. You've improved the welfare of this by that much, and of this by that much, but you've reduced the welfare of the worst 10% by that much. Then there's at least in theory a way of summing this, right? And I'm assuming that we're talking about welfare changes over average income, which wouldn't tell you this, because it might be that in terms of average income, the average income of the bottom 30 has grown considerably, but because of what I was talking about, the principle of diminishing marginal utility, this increase here makes less of a difference to the welfare of this 10% than this smaller decrease makes a difference to the welfare of this 10%. So this might cause lots of misery, whereas that causes only a small amount of additional happiness. Then it might well be that if that's changes in income, that this is a worse situation. But if we assume that these green lines I've drawn represent changes in welfare, somehow we get an accurate idea of how to measure welfare, then you can simply sum these areas, and you can say, okay, well, is there a gain or a loss? Well, let's say this one is about the same as that one, so those two cancel each other out, but then we've got all this additional welfare here. So, yes, this is positive. Or alternatively, of course, you might have a different outcome where you get even with perhaps a small drop of income, as I said, you get a quite substantial loss of welfare here, and you might now say, well, this is bigger than that plus that, right? So therefore, we've got a negative outcome for utility. So it's not that utility is somehow unable to give you answers, it's rather that you need the information that has to be quantitative. It's not enough to say, the bottom of 10% have become worse off. On some other views, it would be, right? Or a Rawlsian view, if we're talking about primary goods here, rather than welfare, which is what he takes as the test. If you've made the bottom 10% worse off, even if you've only made them a tiny bit worse off, this is a worse outcome. Even if you made the next bottom and the one after much better off, according to Rawls, it's still a worse outcome because you have to try to raise the minimum level. And it doesn't really matter what you do apart from raising, you know, the minimum level. So utilitarianism differs from a Rawlsian approach here by saying that you aggregate across all of the groups, and of course, in fact, across 100%, not just across the bottom 30%, but that's just what I was talking about in terms of the differences. So utilitarianism can give you an answer. You may not like the answer it gives you, but it does give you an answer, and it's one that I would in fact defend is more plausible than the Maximin answer that Rawls gives, or that a pure egalitarian gives, which would simply say, you know, any departure from equality is itself also worse, no matter what it does to overall wealth.
The other day when you were talking, if I understood you correctly, you said that in some cases, particularly talking of an ideal, that you might separate what you should do from blaming somebody for not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if in these cases where we're talking about global warming or something, whether you thought in order to convince people to be more responsible, there would be any role for the notion of shame?
Yes, I certainly think there should be. And the question is, how do you produce that? I mean, I definitely think that, say, Americans should be ashamed of the fact that they are not contributing to the solution of a problem that faces the whole world in terms of global warming. And individuals should be ashamed about, if you like, a conspicuously wasteful production of greenhouse gases, something of that sort.
I was thinking of the campaign against the SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think that's a good example.
Should be ashamed of driving this big car.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and some people have attempted that, you know, that's good. I mean, environmental groups have attempted. I saw there was some publicity, in America. There's a large section of the population who you can best reach by appealing to religious arguments. So there was even some group that put up billboards saying, "What kind of car would Jesus have driven?" Which is an interesting speculation. Don't really know his preferences on that, but the assumption is that a caring attitude to everyone that a Christian should follow would mean that you would drive a small car and use little fossil fuel. So, yeah, I definitely think that we have to try using those sorts of strategies as much as we can.